Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Have you maybe have set up a private pension fund, or maybe you're looking to start one, but there's also the issue of the state pension, which can be quite complicated in terms of making sure that you have enough credits to qualify for it. And how does that, how is that impacted if you take a career break, or for example if you take a few years off to look after small children, and what are the things that you need to do to make sure that you will qualify for it? Well, on the line to tell us more, we've John McNicholas, who's CEO of Ethical Financial. John, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Wendy. Nice to be with you.
So what is the current situation with the state pension? How much is it and who qualifies for it?
Yeah, good question. Everyone's favourite topic of pensions, because it is, I won't lie, there is a bit of complexity to it, but it's good. I'm glad you've asked. And the temptation with pensions is to avoid asking the questions, because the answers can be a bit complicated. So I'll try not to complicate them too much, Wendy. Generally speaking, as we stand today, you need to have 10 years of PRSI contributions to qualify for the state pension. So that is...
That can be spread across your career, John, I presume.
Correct.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be 10 consecutive years, in other words.
It doesn't have to be 10 consecutive years, and actually 5 of them can be voluntary contributions, so years you haven't worked but you've paid voluntarily paid your PRSI.
So that's something important to say for someone who worked for a few years and then decided to work in the home, for example, that probably from a financial perspective, the cost of having to pay those 5 years top up would be much less than qualifying for the state pension. Is that right?
Yeah, well, no. So if you're, it's a good point you raise, because that's probably the exception to this, Wendy, when you don't need to be paying voluntary contributions is if you're caring for children in the home under the age of 12, they effectively count as if you're working. So you're not penalised for working in the home and for caring for children, you know. So those years are fine once you have children under the age of 12. It's just other years, if the children are over 12 and you're still out of the workforce, or if you're taking a career break for a few years, they're the kind of years you need to be on top of your game, you know.
Or people, John, for example, might be off work for a number of years because they're sick, they're not well.
Well, again, if you're not well and you're on state illness benefit, you're not penalised for that either. So they count as contributions. Generally speaking, the system is quite fair to most citizens. You know, most people will qualify for a pension, and if they're out of the workforce, as you said, for ill health or for caring for children, they're not penalised for that.
And so, if concerning caring for children in the home, John, you are getting the child benefit from the state, does that kind of automatically give the signal to welfare that you're qualifying for this credit at this time?
Correct, yeah. It's actually only qualified when you come to retire, and they look back and say, oh, let's have a look through Wendy's PRSI history, and they go back through it all, and they'll cross-reference it against the years when you had child benefit. And when the children are under 12, they'll cross-reference it and count those years in your as contributions, you know. So it is a relatively fair system, Wendy, but just... you don't want to get caught out. There's always little kind of quirks to it, you know, that if you're a father working in the family, you know, a father is a homemaker, usually child benefit is paid to the mother. So you need to register the fact that, no, the child benefit is going to, you know, is going to the mother, but I'm actually the carer. So then in that case, you do need to kind of be proactive about registering yourself as the homemaker.
And is that simple? Is that just kind of filling in a form, or is it complicated?
That's just filling in a form. But when I say just filling in a form, forms are usually, in my experience, what petrify everyone and what kind of leads to inertia or not making decisions. They go, oh, paperwork. Well, you know, I don't want to do it. So that's why I think with this whole topic of pensions, Wendy, you kind of have to toughen yourself up, bite the bullet, you know, and just be resolute about
it's a simple rule of thumb. If the child benefit is being paid to someone else other than the parent who's working in the home, that they got to
be proactive. Yeah, be proactive, because the system is there not to penalise parents working in the home. You know, so there's no malintent, shall we say, in anyone's part not to give people a state pension or to, but you do just, it does require sometimes a bit of work yourself. And look, that's generally true, Wendy, of all state benefits and of all, particularly tax relief as well. I won't get into that, but for people who have tax relief to claim, you do have to be proactive yourself about getting all these things, you know.
Yeah, they're not going to hand it to you on a plate. Well, actually, one of the things that's probably important, given that we're talking or focusing about people who are working in the home looking after kids, is I think people can get confused between the homemaker scheme and the home care credit. What are they and what's the difference, and how do you know which one you should be opting for?
Yeah, that's a good question. And at the moment, what you're alluding to, is that actually there's two methods at play at the moment of how you qualify someone, of when you qualify, what state pension you're going to get. There's two different systems in place by the government, and then the government will give you the one that's best for you. So the home carers and the homemaker scheme are one and the same thing, but there's just two different methods at the moment for checking your state pension eligibility, which is not very helpful at all to have two systems in place. It's complicated enough to get one system, to understand one system, never mind understand two. But that is due to change, Wendy. This summer is the expectation that there'll be one system going forward.
So how should you navigate it at the moment?
You should take some advice, probably. Ring Citizens Information rather than trying to spend 3 days yourself working it out. I would ring Citizens Information if you have any queries on it. They're excellent in this space. It's free. They're very knowledgeable on state pension. And look, I ring them personally for queries for clients. I'm happy to ring Citizens Information. It's confidential. You don't have to give name. You don't have to give your name. You don't have to give any details. And they'll give you very good advice to it. So that's really the way to shortcut spending hours hours on the internet, and then ultimately you get frustrated because, look, it just isn't simple. There is intention to make it simple, but there isn't legislation yet in force to do that. So the expectation, the hope, is that this summer it'll be resolved.
What happens, John, if there's someone who, like, they make this phone call and maybe they're coming close to kind of the state pension age and they realise that they haven't got enough contributions for whatever reason? Is there anything they can do at kind of a later stage in their life?
Yeah, it's definitely worth ringing. Yeah, you always can. So, I mean, and a good point to note, Wendy, if your listeners were looking for something, but two things useful I can give you as tidbits. One is to qualify, to get PRSI contributions, you only need to be earning €38 a week from a job, you know. So you're not penalised by being a part-time worker in the workforce either, you know. So at any stage, if you're wondering, oh, I wonder how I'll keep my PRSI contributions up, you know, without making voluntary contributions, without a hassle, a small part-time job, if you can get it, will usually take care of business, so to speak. So even doesn't matter what age you are, once you're before state pension age, you can still try and get a part-time job for yourself or some way to earn money, and that's probably a good rule of thumb anyway. If you're not caring in the home in the Irish system to qualify for good benefits, you probably should try and get some kind of part-time job if that's possible for you.
Finally, just to ask you, John, of course, we're focusing on the state pension today, and I know everybody's needs will differ, and sometimes for people when they're in their 20s, 30s, 40s, it's hard to kind of predict, what are my needs going to be when I retire?
Yes, I've needs now, never mind the needs when I retire.
Would you say that most people need a top-up to the state pension, in other words, that they should be paying into a private pension?
Yeah, I think so, Wendy. Like, it's painful as it is to try and squirrel away money in your 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s when you're working. You might not always have surplus cash, but yeah, it is. So if you take an average of, if we just take a round figure of a state pension being €1,000 a month, that is sufficient to pay your main bills and to pay your food bills. But it's quite tricky to pay for any kind of a private car for yourself, you know. So if you're paying food bills, you won't have a lot of change left out of €1,000 to be paying for insurance, or to be paying for NCTs or repairs in a car. And in Ireland at the moment, you know, our public transport isn't brilliant. Most people will like the option to have a car and to be able to have a bit of freedom with their time. So yes, a private pension is the simplest way to top up to a state pension. If you have a private pension, it doesn't penalise in your state pension, you just get paid it in addition to the state pension. So any kind of money you can squirrel away into a pension in your working life, yeah, it's a great idea. It's a great idea.
All right, John.
The only other caveat I'll say, trying to get an air, because one thing that's missed, Wendy, is a lot of people in Ireland may have spent a few years working in the UK. If you've been working more than 3 years in the UK, you can actually qualify for a UK pension as well as an Irish pension. So if anyone's listening there thinking, I wonder.
No, now I'm thinking,
my mother was a nurse. My mother was a nurse in Essex for 5 years or something like that. That's a good thing. That makes a massive difference. It can be doubling your state pension. Rather than 1,000 a month, you get 2,000 a month. So it's very valuable. So if you know anyone personally, Wendy, who's worked in the UK for a few years, tell them to give me a shout or to get researching their national insurance contributions. So that applies to a lot of people in Ireland, actually.
Yeah, great advice, John. As always, thanks so much for joining us on the show. That's John McNicholas, the CEO of Ethical Financial. If you want to get in touch with John or anyone in Ethical Financial to get some advice on some of the issues we've been talking about today, you can go to their website where you can get all their contact details at ethicalfinancial.ie. Spirit. So it's Holy Week. It is the most important week in the Christian calendar, where we think about, well, who was Jesus and what happened at this time? But, you know, for many of you listening, it might mean much to you at all. But how can you use this time to recharge your spiritual batteries? And you know what? My next guest, something that he's going to talk about is actually if we enter into these incredible historic events that changed the world forever, you'll really be able to fill the sails of your spiritual life. With me as our prayer coach this week, I have Andy Carroll, who's minister at Donabate Presbyterian Church in North Dublin. Andy, good morning to you.
Hi, Wendy. Lovely to be on with you.
So, Andy, you know, when I think of this time of year, obviously for yourself and for many people listening, they'll be celebrating Holy Week in a very different way.
Yeah, listen, I mean, it's a huge challenge for churches, for Christians, for people who are trying to work this out. This is a week where people do have the opportunity, maybe for the first time or a renewed time, to look again at Christianity, and for Christians to be thinking about the significance of Easter. And we have lost a lot this year. Like, people feel like they've lost a lot. Irish Times survey says the thing that people are missing most are relationships, or just missing gathering with people, missing their friends. I mean, we feel that, don't we? But there's an amazing story at the beginning of the Easter narrative in the Bible that appears in three of the Gospels. And it's a story about that actually teaches us something about what we do have now. Jesus is in the home of somebody called Simon the leper. He's there, and a woman comes, and she does an amazing thing. She brings an alabaster jar of perfume, really expensive, probably her life savings, worth the annual kind of wage of the day. So in Irish terms, that's about €30,000 a year for the average worker. She smashes it and she pours it over Jesus. And the disciples are like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing with this? And Jesus kind of rebukes them. He says, no, what she's done is a beautiful thing. You'll always have the poor, he says. And you're thinking, what's more important than using what we have for the poor? And he says, no, you'll always have the poor. She won't always have me. And essentially what she's doing is an act of worship. And Wendy, one of the things that we've lost loads, but what we do have is God. What we do have is the ability to meet with God and know God. When you trust Jesus, when you put your faith in him, we actually still have the most important thing that we need for human flourishing, which is God. And I suppose this is a week for us to be reminded of how we can have God. What does it mean to have him, and how do we get it?
Why is a good place to start, you know, Andy, for people listening who are they're thinking about it, they're thinking about Easter time, and they're thinking, yeah, what's it all about? And maybe I need to think about this whole story again. Mm-hmm. But then I think what can happen is, you know, the biblical accounts of Jesus' passion and all the events running up to it, they're detailed, they're dramatic. Mm-hmm. For some people, they might feel it's fascinating. For others, mm-hmm. it might be overwhelming. So where is a good place to start to try and enter into it, understand it all?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, starting, if you can, starting with what the Bible says about these events and reading them slowly. I always think people should start a gospel if they're going to read, you know, and that's where you read about it in the Bible. Read a gospel. And I suppose particularly in this week, and especially as we're thinking about prayer and what it is to not just know in some sort of theoretical way about God, but actually encounter him. And what people have been finding for generations, and I'm not from a church background, and I found this when I sat down to read the Bible for the first time, I didn't just read it, but it read me. And so prayer became a thing, not just me speaking, but actually hearing God speak to me. And so God invites us actually into encounter with him. And I'm finding all the time that people of all kinds of backgrounds are actually having the experience of meeting with God when they pray and when they sit down to meditate on the Bible. And a good thing to, I think, to realize is a lot of people, when they think about this word meditate, okay, meditation in the kind of the Eastern sense sort of means to empty yourself and to empty yourself and try and enter into a position of kind of, experience, you know, emptying yourself of all desire and experiencing kind of nothing. The Bible actually says meditation is exactly the opposite. It means to fill yourself, to stop, to put aside the things that you're doing, and to let God fill you with what he has to say through the Bible. So I think that's a great place for people to start. It's not rocket science. You don't need to do it for an hour and a half every day or do a course. You just start, and you just make a decision to start doing it.
I think that's really good advice in terms of just putting one foot in front of the other and making a start. What about just when you think of what Jesus knew in terms of what lay ahead of him? He knew what was to come. He knew the pain that he would go through for all of us. Mm-hmm. And so it makes a lot of things when you think about everything he did in the days leading up to his crucifixion all the more poignant.
Yeah, and listen, I mean, it's so evocative, it's so meaningful, it's so significant that it really does take entering it again, and also, I suppose, for a lot of people it's relatively familiar, but when we stop and we consider that what the disciples who followed Jesus came to believe was this man Jesus was God himself on the earth, the maker of everything, willing, and I mean choosing, because he had loads of opportunities to not be in Jerusalem at that time. He knew what was going to happen. But as he says, he came to give his life as a ransom for many. That means to free people. And thinking and reflecting in prayer this week on Jesus being willing to do that. And Ephesians says the reason that God does that is out of a heart of love. Why does God do this? Because he loves us. Why does he love us? Well, because he loves us, because he loves us, because he loves us. We don't even know. And that's the starting point, that this is a father of love welcoming people to encounter him in faith in Jesus.
In terms of just trying to do that idea, Andy, of recharging the batteries or filling the sails, whatever way you want to put it, for people who, you know, church is an important part of their life, but it's been really difficult over the last year and we're facing into another Easter without being able to attend public worship, and you just feel, oh, usually at this time of year, I'm able to kind of enter into, you know, Jesus' passion, think about the Last Supper, all these things, because I have this connection, but that's not there. How do I do it without all of that? How do I recharge?
Honestly, it's really hard. Honestly, it is really hard, and I don't want to underplay that. I don't want to underplay, you know, people say, oh, yeah, you know, there's all of these good things, because there are good things happening. But there is no question that this is just really hard for people at the moment. A key way that God gives us to encounter and experience him is when his people gather together, and we can't do that. And not having that is actually massively detrimental to our faith. But there are things, there are ways of gathering, and we do have Zoom, and we do have, you know, the other ways of doing that. And there is a real tangible experience of God meeting with his people, even in those ways. But there's great resources on YouTube, but there's also just people taking a decision themselves to say, hold on a second, I'm going to do this. And like one of the things, social media is so useful in so many ways, but I really do think that there's something, and particularly for particular platforms, maybe particular ones, more recent ones like TikTok, maybe like Instagram, where the feedback loop is so addictive, where you put something up and you want a response immediately, and it's just so, it contains us. Actually, there's something that we need to do, which is to set those things down and say, I'm going to engage in the practice of listening to God, where the feedback loop is a little bit different, where it takes different skills and it takes different disciplines, but the rewards for it are, in terms of our of who we are and our true humanity, are just way beyond any feedback that we could get on those platforms.
Yeah, and it's one of the things to probably remind ourselves for. One of the things that I know that helps me kind of remind myself of the importance of the Easter story, maybe it's a ritual at this stage, is watching the Passion of Christ.
Yeah, yeah.
Or something like that. Is there anything like that that you could recommend? Is there books? Is there films? Well, obviously, outside of the Bible that you've mentioned.
Yeah, genuinely, there is loads. You know, there's loads of resources out there. I mean, anyone look up talks and things on Easter, but I do think a starting point for people is being honest with yourself, and this isn't a resource, but it's being actually looking at yourself and analysing yourself and saying, where am I with this? Where am I with prayer? And you don't need just do this on Easter week. And I've used somebody, I've heard somebody use the kind of picture of a sailboat on this. And I'm a true Northsider, so I know nothing about sailing. Okay, so. So the picture is of four kind of aspects. Like, are you sailing? Is your prayer life sailing? And that's a sense that God is real. You've got the kind of wind of the Spirit in your sails, and prayer life comes easy to you. Maybe you're rowing. Maybe you do have a heart for God, but when you go to pray, it just feels tough, and it feels like you're rowing through treacle. But you keep going. You keep going, and you press on. Or maybe you're drifting. Maybe you feel like this is really tough. Prayer life is hard, and you begin to give into a bit of self-pity, like, God isn't listening to me. Maybe I'll just stop doing this. Maybe I'll just keep watching the TV, keep scrolling on Twitter, you know, doing all of that. And maybe even 40, you could be in the worst, which is really where a lukewarmness turns to real hardness in your heart, and you feel like you're sinking. So a place to start is to be honest and say, where am I in my prayer life? And now what resources might I look to help me with this? And I mean, I love to encourage people to read the kind of daily devotional stuff where you get a thought from somebody else. Bible in 1 Year by the people from Alpha, I think is brilliant for that. One place I love to look at the moment is the Bible Project, and they do little videos, and they've got a video for every book of the Bible. They've got explanations of themes in the Bible. And again, sort of 8 minutes long, not hard to get you in there, but it does take you saying, I'm actually going to go and I'm going to do this.
Spirit. Of course, there was announcements made yesterday in relation to what changes we might expect in April and May in relation to current restrictions. So what are the changes that are going to be proposed in relation to allowing public worship? And has the response so far in terms of really our churches and places of worship being closed for the best part of a year, has that been proportionate? You might have heard stories about Garda checkpoints. I believe there was 3 of them erected close to a church in County Cavan because a parish priest there, Father PJ Hughes, has been saying Mass, and he's also received fines as well. So is this response proportionate? On the line to tell us more, we've Michael Kelly, who's the editor of the Irish Catholic, to tell us all about what's going on at the moment. Michael, good morning to you.
Hey, Wendy, good morning.
So what was the announcement yesterday in terms of restrictions? When are they going to be eased? When will those who want to go back to church again and worship publicly be able to do so?
Well, look, the short answer is we don't know. The government haven't been very forthcoming about it. The Taoiseach mentioned that they would be looking at a possible return to public worship towards the end of May. So really it's as vague as that. And it's also contingent on vaccine rollout, which to this point has not been ideal, I think we can say. And it also rests on the COVID numbers, at the very least, remaining static or going down. So the government say they're going to look at it again at the beginning of May with a view to restoring it at the end of May. So it's quite a while off yet. We're talking ultimately about 2 more months if the government sticks to their guns on this.
And how does that compare, Michael, to how other European countries have been handling worship in particular, in recognition that to many it is an essential service?
Oh, we've been the most draconian in Europe, not only in restricting public worship, but as we know now, also attaching a penal offence to it. So we've been among the most restrictive. And actually what you have seen all across Europe, where governments have brought in guidelines in terms of churches, they have not made it a penal offence, but where they have brought in guidelines all across Europe, courts have struck those guidelines down precisely because the right to religious freedom, the right to public worship is considered a fundamental right. And that's not just me saying that. That's the European Convention on Human Rights, that's the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights. Our own constitution in Article 44 guarantees the right to public worship, and that's why I think you've seen all across Europe where these things have been challenged in court. It's been struck down most recently in Scotland, where the decision of the Scottish government to ban public worship, that was considered to be disproportionate by the court legislative sessions there, which is effectively the equivalent of Scotland's Supreme Court.
And there's a case ongoing here at the moment, Michael, and I know clarification was sought from the government where the question was being asked, is this an offence for, you know, a priest like Father PJ Hughes or a minister or anyone of any faith to hold public worship, or is it a recommendation? Has there been clarity on that?
Well, I mean, Wendy, there was in the 1980s, they coined a political phrase, a silent goo-boo, to describe a political situation which was thought at the time to be grotesque, unbelievable, bizarre and unprecedented. We got the clarification from the government about this at the weekend, and contrary to what the Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, has been saying in the Dáil consistently, the government, I understand, wrote to Declan Ganley, who is taking the High Court case to try to overturn this ban. They wrote to him saying that they consider it to be an offence for either a priest or a minister to leave their home for the purpose of conducting a service except a wedding or a funeral. Likewise, for a parishioner or a member of the congregation to leave their home with the intention of going to their church to participate in a public act of worship, that is a criminal offence and it's subject to penal sanction. Now, Stephen Donnelly told it all that that was not the case, that these were merely regulations, that no penalty would be attached to them. So that's why you have prominent politicians now like Senator Ronan Mullen, Carol Nolan, Peter Tobin, people like that, calling on the minister to clarify his position, because, you know, one would have to give the minister of the benefit of the doubt and say that it was unintentional, but it's a very, very serious matter to mislead the Oireachtas.
And that's the thing, Michael. I mean, when you consider the impact that that headline could have, you know, if the government is saying it's illegal to attend public worship, given our constitution, given our right to religious freedom, given our history, that would be, I mean, I would be, I'm surprised it hasn't gotten more attention that that might be the case.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You don't have to be an historian to understand the resonances of banning people going to church in a country with our history. I mean, it leaves a very, very bitter taste in the mouth. And I think what you will see is probably a lot more publicity around this when the court case comes up again on April 13th, and the government is standing in open court and effectively announcing to the entire world that in 21st century Ireland, they are criminalising people who want to attend public worship in their churches, a rite which happens, you know, from where Father PJ is in County Cavan, just a few miles across the border. Everyone there can legally attend Mass, and even when there were restrictions in place, those restrictions were voluntary. Why were those restrictions voluntary? Quite precisely because the Northern Ireland executive understood the very important fact that religious freedom is not something that you tamper with. Restricting public worship is not something that you do lightly. So they sought a cooperative approach from the church authorities there, and of course that cooperative approach was forthcoming, because the churches and church leaders right across the Christian traditions have been very willing to work with the government on this and very compliant. But I think that compliance is wearing a bit thin as they see congregations in Northern Ireland celebrating freely, as they see congregations all across other parts of Europe worshipping freely as well. I think perhaps that goodwill has been taken a little bit for granted by the government, and it's certainly wearing thin at this stage. I mean, we saw reported on Gripped during the week a video of a pastor, a Protestant pastor, what appeared to being arrested in his church for what appears to have been celebrating a Sunday liturgy. Now, the circumstances weren't entirely clear from the video. It was a little bit shaky, but that is how it appears. And if it is as it appears, then I think that is extremely serious. I think you would have to go a long way back in Irish history to find a time when somebody was arrested for celebrating a public liturgy.
And tell us a little bit more about that story of Father PJ Hughes in County Cavan and the response to, I think I read that there was something like 20 or 30 people in his church. Has the response been proportionate in your opinion, Michael?
Well, I think whoever is responsible for coordinating the policing around the situation in County Cavan, I think they have very, very serious questions to answer. I think this is a case of using a sledgehammer to crack a nut. Effectively, what is happening in Mullaghore and in County Cavan is that Father PJ Hughes has decided that he is going to continue celebrating public mass. What he says is he leaves the doors open and people are free to come in and attend. It's important to point out that this is in defiance of his bishop. His local bishop has asked him not to do this, but Father Hughes clearly feels that he's serving a higher call in so doing. But what we witnessed at the weekend, Wendy, was the the Gardaí, who have always prided themselves on policing by consent. But at the weekend, we saw the Gardaí erect 3 roadblocks around the church to prevent people from attending. So let that image sink in 2021 of roadblocks outside a parish church in rural Ireland preventing people from going to Mass. And look, I think that is draconian, to say the least. Senator Regina Doherty, the Fine Gael leader of the Senate, who certainly has been a very outspoken critic of the Catholic Church, let's face it, she tweeted on Sunday night to say that she felt the fining of Father Hughes was one of the saddest things that she's seen during the pandemic. Similarly, the former Justice Minister, Charlie Flanagan, who again has been very critical of the Catholic Church in the past. So these are not the kind of usual voices that you'd expect to speak up. He has described the policing there as very divisive. Now, coming from a former Minister for Justice who had responsibility for a long period for policing, Charlie Flanagan is not nobody, as they say.
What about, Michael, people who say, look, it is really hard, it's difficult that churches are closed, but they're closed for a reason, to protect people and to keep people safe, and, you know, that by people attending that church, let's say in County Cavan, that they could be putting themselves or others at risk?
Yeah, and look, that's a very real concern. I mean, we know that this pandemic is deadly. We have had huge numbers of deaths in this country, particularly since Christmas, since the so-called third wave. So there obviously is a concern there, which is not illegitimate. But at the same time, when the churches were open, the flow of people, the sanitizing, the stewarding, I mean, there were literally an army of volunteers ensuring that the churches are safe. And consistently, when the National Public Health Emergency Team, when they are asked for evidence as to why they are closing the churches, no evidence is forthcoming. So that would certainly lead one to believe that that evidence is not present. We've also seen all across Europe where churches are open with small numbers. Because look, we're not talking here about a free-for-all. No one expects that a church that holds 1,500 people on Easter Sunday morning should be allowed to have 1,500 people inside. What we're talking is small, controlled groups of people who should be allowed to gather. That is what's happening all across Europe. And again, we have no evidence from those countries that we're having outbreaks there, or even that it is contributing to the spread of the virus in other places. So I think keeping the churches closed this long has been disproportionate, particularly since they've shown that they can manage these things well. I mean, you go to your local supermarket and people are reaching across one another for bread and milk. You compare that to the scenario in the local church, and it is a world of difference.
Michael, thanks so much for joining us on the programme.
Thanks,
Wendy. That update. That's Michael Kelly there, the editor of the Irish Catholic. And if you want to stay up to date with the news that the Irish Catholic produces, you can go to their website, irishcatholic.ie.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.